Clifford. Yeah, I think we can at least work until 10 to 3. It's fine. So that we can even stretch it up to 3 o'clock. The questions to the economic cluster ministers is at 3. So we must be there by 3. So let's start with the WNR CETA, and then who presented next? MQA, and then Transport and Education Training Authority.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. I will take few of the questions and delegate further to the CEO and the Chairperson of the Finance Committee. On the issue, let me put into this that the issue of the turnaround strategy is a plan which we are not intending to have, is a plan which is already there, yielding the desired results to address those issues. On the question around the backlog, it was not about abandoning of projects. It was quality assurance because of out of the backlog which was in the system, some of the training was paid for by the industry itself. But we have a responsibility of SSCTA for quality assurance and issuing out of certificates. So that backlog has already being eradicated. So the 17,000 are the ones, 100%, which were in the system, which were due for certification. However, certain projects which are still continuing, we have extended the contract because of there is still work which needs to be done. So we can safely say, you know, with 17,000 of certificates which have been issued, we have eradicated that backlog because of the ones which are currently running are not counted as backlog because of there is an extension. And also the issue we are unable to account as to where are those learners, because of we give the certificates to the employers, the industry who registers them on the system. So it is up to them to go and find them. Whether they are working or not, my assumption is that we cannot assume they are working because of they haven't received the certificates. It's only now at the end of the financial year that they receive the certificates. And in terms of consequence management, we started last year with consequence management. Even though we did not have a CEO, the executives did not get bonuses. Even this year, they did not get bonuses, and we were taken to court for that, and we are defending ourselves as a governance that we cannot award and reward mediocre performance. And on the issue of the sector not taking opportunities, it's about also one of the pressure points which we have identified in the 7 pillars of the short turnaround strategy, the issue of being responsive to the needs of the industry. We were using policies which a one-size-fits-all approach. The way you deal with a big retailer and a small retailer, and the way you deal with other entities. Because of the window period in which we advertise discretionary grant, it is an issue of timing. The sector has spoken and said, if you advertise anything in December, November, that's peak period for us for business to boom because of its festive season. We are not going to look into those issues. So we need to amend, also cater for the times whereby they are able to send people for training, they are able to take this. It was about a relationship building to understand what your clientele needs and so forth. And also the issue of how we've been allocating. We've been allocating short, small numbers whereby it did not make economic sense for any viable business to invest and appoint a service provider to come and train five people. So now we have looked into the strategies, how we're going to ensure that we have a consistent effort. If we give a large number to a particular subsector, we focus on it for this particular year and then we move forward. And there was a question raised about capacity in the SCM. Yes, we must admit that the SCM is the weakest link in the organization. We have spoken to National Treasury around the issue of capacitating them. But however, as part of the turnaround strategy on the people issues, there is a skills audit which has been approved so that it's implemented and then we know how to train the people, where, whether they are qualified there. But it has been the weakest link, but also it's one of those issues whereby in the SEM, because of investigations, points a lot on the ECM, which leads to fear of officials having to take decisions, though you find that those decisions have far-reaching consequences for the sector. On the issue, a chairperson, around the public protector investigation, yes, we got an inquiry from public protector. We have requested an extension which was granted yesterday in order to respond, because of we need to go to the archives and find documentation to attach to as verification documents. But we will, however, finish the chairperson with the response. It is due by the 15th of November. We'll finish the chairperson with our response. I think the other issues will be addressed by the CEO and the chairperson of the Finance Committee.
Thanks, Chairperson. I will just go back to the question related to the unskilled within the Employment Equity Report. It's only 14 posts of office assistants. So those are the employees that are assisting us in terms of cleaning and whatever. Otherwise, most of our employees are semi-skilled, going upwards in the organization. That's one issue that I wanted to address. There was a question about special projects. We've got a number of special projects in the organization. One, we've got an international leadership development program. It is focused on 60 of those employees that are working in management, that we need to take them to a level higher. It's either they get into senior positions within the sector or they open their own business, so it's currently running, so they get an international exposure into three countries, to East, West, and Africa. So Ghana, USA, Russia, and China, and India. We also have got an RMDP program that is also looking at the junior management group. It's a retail management program that we've got in place. We've got a number of projects looking at SMMEs in particular, because our sector it's got a lot of informal traders in our sector. So we've approved a number of projects as a board. So we probably have a space to just share that information, but it's an information that we can share as an organization. Then when it comes to the issue of the fruitless and wasteful expenditure, the amount is 287,000. It's not 287 million. It was a late payment to SAS that was made. Was paid late, so I just wanted to clarify that, and unfortunately the employee involved left already within the organization. However, we've dealt with the issue of consequence management that we probably need to follow those people that are.
So it says 287,000.
Yes, 287.
Not million.
Yes, not million. Yes. Okay, and then on the issue of the irregular expenditure, 6.5 million went mainly on SCM.
It was either a contract that had expired, or in some cases included buildings, and in some cases, again, this was just an issue of capacity, because if people that were in the environment, they understood what they were supposed to do, those issues are not supposed to have been irregular expenditure. So I think we're working on that, and the chairperson has spoken about that particular issue. Then the other amount of money of 5.1, in terms of the grant regulations, the CETA, when an employer submits a
what is the explanation on the irregular expenditure? The irregular expenditure, what is the explanation there?
The explanation, firstly, 6.5 million is on SCM, supply chain, mainly. It was expired contracts, mainly for buildings, for offices. The way that, what is quite strange is that people were working in an organization, but the contract expired. And no one was taking control in terms of making sure that those contracts are renewed or we go out on a tender on time. So those were the main issues. Others were issues that were just related to, for example, when you advertise on the newspaper and you need a person a delegated person to approve. I want to advertise on a national newspaper rather than a provincial newspaper. Someone must approve that. And it could be also issues related to, there were also issues related to the mandatory grants. That's passed on FCM. And then on mandatory grant application was about 5.1 million. So it's an amount of money that we paid on discretionary grants. However, what had happened is that the system clocked up when the employers were supposed to be making their submissions. And the CEO at the time decided to give an extension, so which was in contrary to grant regulations, because it is the board that was supposed to have made that extension. So subsequently the board has delegated that function to me, so that if that happens, I am able to, as a CEO, to ensure. So you can see that just issues that could have been sorted out, but just lack of managing managing of issues. And then the other issue on the irregular expenditure was an amount of about 383,000, where a position was on a structure, and I think it's part of the public protector's report, where a person was appointed. There was one position, but where the person was appointed on a position that did not exist. That was created. So those are just
maybe let's give us the details in writing of those.
Okay.
The irregular and the fruitless expenditure.
We'll do the
details of the contract, all of those issues that.
Yes. Now, thanks.
Amounts to that.
Yes. Then on the forensic audit reports, the board set up a committee. However, when I just been appointed, the board had taken a decision to take the matters to National Treasury. But National Treasury was not assisting in the process. Then subsequently the board decided that the matter must then be dealt with. And the matters were divided into three. One, it was issues where we needed to recover money, recover funds, and it's amount of about 1.8 million rand that we need to recover. We started that process. So some of those service providers are coming back to us, asking us for more details. details. We're moving with that. Then the other issue is about 70 employees that were implicated in the report. Okay, so it was only 70 employees that were implicated in the forensic report where disciplinary actions needed to be taken against them. So, and in some cases, disciplinary actions did take place. So it means when there was a changeover of the board and the administrator, the action will be taken. And when the other grouping comes back, then they would lift the decision that has been taken or a suspension that has been made. So the matters are a little bit complicated now from a labor point of view, because in some cases you might have double jeopardy in the system. So we are busy with that process. We are finalizing that issue on the 7th of November, and the ad hoc committee is assisting me with that process. And one of the determinations that then we will therefore make on that particular day is those where there are criminal issues that we need to deal with. If I look at the report, probably there is none of issues that we need to deal with. However, we can therefore give you a report after the 15th in terms of what action plan we're moving forward and where we're going forward with that particular issue.
Thank you, and I'll give over to the CFO and then thereafter the COO.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, I will respond to two issues that have been raised. Firstly, the first one was on the clarity that was sought on the slide of the financial position of the CETA in relation to discretionary grants and why there is a significant movement between the two financial years. In 2017-18, our total net reserves amounted to 2 billion. That increased to 2.5 billion in the year under review, and that increase is a reflection of the net operating surplus of the CETA. So in essence, it's the amount not spent, which is of the value of 439 million. So our surplus for the current year is 439 million, which adds to the opening balance to arrive at the 2.5 billion balance. What we are then further disclosing to the committee is that of that 2.5 billion in reserves, the total value that the CETA was able to contract and commit to various employers as well as stakeholders within the sector amounted to 1.6 billion. That leaves us with a total value of uncommitted funding of 872 million, which we have applied to National Treasury to obtain permission that we can roll over those funds to the next financial year. So that is how the slide works. And Chairperson, then the last question that was raised on our financial results is the overall spending of 72% on expenditure compared to the actual performance achievement of 31% in our financial reporting, and how do we then explain that? The main reason for that, Chairperson, is that the current year's expenditure relates in the main to the backlog that we referred to earlier. So in essence, we are paying expenditure on projects, some of which have been implemented in prior years. Now that performance is not necessarily translated to current year report. That's the one element of it. The other element is the explanation insofar as how the 31% is calculated versus your expenditure value. So the expenditure value is a cumulative value. whereas your 31% is only based on simply applying the rule of is it achieved or not achieved. So it doesn't factor into account how much achievement was achieved. But all in all, Chairperson, the message is the CETA has not achieved its targets from a performance point of view, and we are committed to a process that will improve both the expenditure line item as well as overall performance of the CETA. I think there's also another one, Chairperson, that the CEO has not covered, which was an explanation of the qualification. The audit qualification is on the commitment value, which is 1.6 billion, and in the opening balance, it's about 800 million. So what the AG found was that included in the opening balance, which is the balance on 1 April 2018, included in that balance were expired contracts with a total value of 41 million rand, as they've quantified it. And the task they've given us is to say there must be consistent treatment of these expired contracts. They can't be reflected as commitments. On the other hand, we have a disclosure of contingent liabilities. We will attend to that. We have formulated a plan of action to deal with that issue, Chairperson, and we are comfortable that the results we will present at year-end will be much better than what is currently the status as it stands. Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson?
Just before the CEO tackles the issues of performance, just on the last matter that the CFO dealt with, we just want to explain to members, honourable members and the chairperson, that indeed, you know, in terms of the audit, what was submitted on the 31st of March as the balance sheet and income statement for the WNR CETA, there actually were no changes to it, except for that disclosure item relating to prior year. There was actually no change. There was actually nothing that Auditor General had to find, you know, necessary to change in those accounts. So the accounting records and the manner in which everything was accounted for was actually correct, which is testament to the work that, you know, the audit committee has actually embarked on with the finance team within. In actual effect, if the Auditor General had found the error in the opening balance relating to the 2017-18 financial year, last year, the qualification would have been last year and not in the 2018-2019 financial year. This year, you know, we would have actually had an unqualified audit report. I think it's important for members to note, simply because it was not picked up last year, because of the comparative numbers, we are now have to suffer for that. So it's not a case of you were unqualified, you then became, sorry, you were unqualified, and then you had disqualification, and then things are changing again. You know, it's a case of, you know, there was a qualified, unqualified, and then it's now, it would have been unqualified this year. That really would have been the true reflection. But, you know, we try to argue, you know, with Auditor General on this matter, and we could not prevail, unfortunately.
Thank you. Let me just read you what the Auditor General says. It says that the financial statements submitted for auditing were not prepared in accordance with the prescribed financial reporting framework as required by Section 55. Subsection 1B of the PFMA. The uncorrected material misstatements of commitments and discretionary reserves resulted in the financial statements receiving a qualified opinion. So this is what the AG is saying, not what you are saying. It further says there's a lot of findings on your annual financial statement. There's a lot of them. I can read it to you. The internal control deficiencies, which are about five of them, the issue about irregular expenditure year,
appropriate steps not taken to prevent the regular expenditure of 6.5 million. Goods and services with a transaction value of 500,000 procured without obtaining the required price quotations. There were material findings and misstatements in respect of the usefulness and reliability and all of that. So I don't think that it's correct that you must come and present a picture as if there were no issues. I think you must come up with an action plan that addresses all of the findings that are here. Remember, we did request that please don't sugarcoat, as Yao was saying, the issues, and don't even try and justify. So as it is, there are a lot more issues in your audit report, a lot more findings that you have to talk to. So please check.
Could I just make one comment? On the matter of the audit findings, indeed, there were audit findings by the Auditor General, and audit findings, there were about 31 audit findings, and these have actually, and this is actually quite factual, have come down from about 55 in the previous year. The matter that I was referring to is just that the submitted audited financial statements, the numbers, the balance sheet and the income statement, bar for the issue of the qualification, were actually unchanged by the Auditor General. The issues that you raise relate to the audit findings. There were about 31 of them. We're not sugarcoating anything. Those are the issues that the Auditor General is referring to. If you think that I must apologize if I painted a completely incorrect picture. If I may put it that way. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Chair, I'll just pick up on two issues on performance. The first one, the Honourable Member asked why Western Cape receives a large chunk of training. Unfortunately, the wholesale and retail sector is skewed. It's headquartered in the Western Cape, most of them. Most of it is headquartered in the Western Cape, but we'll be the first ones to agree that this picture should change, and we'll work towards that. The second question that was asked was about the learners who did not get bursaries, continuing learners. Where are they? Are they lost? the reporting is, as at 31st of March, those learners were not reported, but they are in the system. In other words, they were reported late, so they could not be counted. It's not that they are totally out of the system. The target was 1,000 learners. As at 31st of March, we reported 509. So there's a difference of 491. So I think the question is, what happened to this 491? So they are still in the system. The MOUs with the universities were received late. So hence they are not in the report. So it appears as if they are totally out of the system. They are in the system. They will probably be reported in this 1920 financial year. So I thought I should report that, Chair. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're done with the WNRC. You'll give us the information that you asked for in writing. Can you go to Mining Qualifications Authority?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. The responses in some of the areas will be in principle. And I'll also allow my colleague Mustaq Ali to respond to some of the issues that were raised by Honourable Spear regarding and also the Honourable Member from the EFF regarding what the sector is doing. And CEO will also respond to some of the issues. regarding the issues raised by Honorable Mananiso, I think there was an issue raised on the progress in place on just gender-based violence. And I think one of the things that I must also highlight and the colleagues will speak to is that since the introduction of the MPRDA, the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Act, in 2002, the number of women employed at the mines increased from about 11,000 in 2002 to currently just below 60,000. And the number of mines employed increased from about 900 to about 1.9, almost 2,000, the number of mines that we have on record. The employees currently employed is about 458,000 people. One of the things that we have as a department that we have realized the great problem has been the violence against women at the mines themselves and the issue of sexual harassment, especially underground. Some of the women have been attacked, and I think unfortunately we had cases about 5 years ago where two women were killed underground. Hence, together with the sector, including organized labor, through the Mine Health and Safety Council, we came up with programs to deal with this particular matter. So since then, since 2015, there are clear programs that we are dealing with. In fact, in August this year, we had a Women in Mining in Daba. We took women from all the provinces. We engaged with them on, say, what measures can we put in place further to deal with them. In 2015, for instance, one of the biggest issues on the safety side that we were dealing with, women have been complaining about their PPEs. You know, they are given the same overalls that they give to the men, the safety boots, the hats, and so forth. So we've changed that. We came up with guidelines to help the sector as well. So I think it's a continuous program that we are also working on to ensure that there's significant improvement also on the issue of health and safety regarding and security regarding the women themselves. And in the issue, the other issues, Honorable Mananiso, I think my colleagues will touch on the special projects, and I agree with you. Our target is 100% achievement of our targets, of the targets that we've set ourselves. On issues of governance, and my colleague, the CFO, has indicated that one of the things that the board is put more emphasis on is a clean audit. I know it does not necessarily mean that corruption is not there or we don't have challenges of governance, but we do put an emphasis on clean audit. In fact, when the performance assessments are done of executives, one of the key things that we look at. Hence, he said, Mr. Mdingi, that we have not received bonuses, because we also look at that. We don't only look at performance information. We look at a lot of things, including these cases that we deal with, to ensure that there's no recurrence. Honorable Speer, on the issues of fruitless and wasteful expenditure, my colleague will respond to it. However, you've also asked the question why people are not interested in mining. I think the reason, although it has improved significantly, the main reason is the legacy issues. The unfortunate thing about our mining sector, people, when they think about our mining sector, they think about, hey, will I come back alive? And you can't blame them, because at one stage, the mines have been reporting about 800 fatalities a year. They've been having disasters almost every month. They've been reporting about 20,000 injuries a year, 18,000 diseases a year. So, and when you look at that, it was a big challenge, especially for the youth. And mining is a dirty industry, so to speak. It's not a clean, like we are wearing it. You have to wear overalls and to go underground. However, through our career guidance programs, we do also inform that there's been significant improvement in the sector that we have made. For instance, this year I've said that it's the safest year ever. Our fatalities are less than 40, and we are not happy. From 800 to 40, we're still not happy. We want our aspiration is zero. That's our aspiration, and we're already working on that. And so it's a constant thing that we also encourage people to say, look, through career guidance, through community engagement, to say the government, working together with the organized labor and business, we are implementing measures, because we don't believe we can do it alone as the government. And honorable, note that we do agree on consequence management, and we, as I've indicated earlier on, we took matters to the Hawks, and we do engage with them, and those matters, they are still investigating them, but if they need further assistance from us, we are willing to provide. And internally as well, I think it's very important that we strengthen our controls whilst also taking disciplinary steps against the respective people. It's very important for us to strengthen our internal controls to prevent repeats. I think for us, it's key. In terms of the capacity, I think it's honorable TAC, if I'm not mistaken, he was asking whether is the sector doing enough to also augment what the MQA is doing in skills development, bursaries, and so forth. My colleague is here, but what I would also like to add is that beyond the programs of the MQA, right, I've referred to the MPRDA. The main issue, the main objective of the MPRDA was that is that that there must be optimal exploitation of our minerals. Our people must benefit, and we must redo the past imbalances, especially with our African people. In other words, there must be improvement of transformation. Now, to support the MPRDA in achieving that, the department has developed and published what we call the Mining Charter, which give more emphasis on DEEs, communities, and mine workers as well, because mine workers are the ones who are also digging.
Chair, now we are reporting on mineral resources issues.
I'll stick to
the CETA
okay.
Training.
I'll do the tax.
I know there is a temptation to do that, because this is your daily job, but let's stick to the...
My apology, Chair.
The CETA.
My perspective to raise that is that through the Mining Charter as well, and also the MPRDA, it speaks to SLPs. And in both documents, it promotes skills development, including issuing of bursaries, and that my colleague can further respond to regarding that. In terms of Zamazamas, I think Honorable Yabo, yes, we are working together with the respective state entities to train the communities and also assist them to legislate them. And I'll, Chairperson, we should also bear with me, because some of the work that has been done through the DMR in terms of licensing, because that's the department licenses provide prospecting and mining right, and mining rights to assist them. So we do work on that. But also what is key, there are certain minerals that are being mined that will also help in terms of being negotiated. So through the MQA, there are programs that we are also dealing with that. I think that will also respond to Honorable Tsiye, the question that is posed. And Honorable Mkatshwa, we agree in terms of better planning. I think we'll also look at the targets, relook at the targets, but one of the main causes was that we had a dip in revenue, and in the last few years we've seen a significant improvement. So I think, and other programs, we're working together with the sector. So I think it's very important to really look at that as well, to make sure that we put better targets. And I think we've covered most of the key issues. I don't know from my colleague Mustak, would you like to talk more on the sector and in terms of skills development, and my colleagues will come in from the CEO and CFO. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, my Chair of the MQA, Honourable Chair of PPC, and Honourable Members. Just very quickly, and it relates to two of the questions that we had from Honourable Borshoff and Honourable Kietse. And one doesn't want to do a representation of what we do as a mining sector and the companies therein. But I think it's been said that we expend over and above the 1%. The mining sector actually pays a further 5% towards HRD and skills development. Now, the question was raised, is our employees not taking up the programs, and why in this hard-pressed socioeconomic context are we not completing programs, or we have learners not really going through with programs? It's because of this way that this specific legislation is structured that the companies have to expend 5%. Unlike BBBE, where it's voluntary, this is a must. So the companies would look at funding, etc., to the MQA once they've really planned their programs to hit the 5% spend, which needs to cover the SLP as well as the mining charter. So that's why you have the scenario where you have certain areas where it looks like we're not achieving the target in terms of employees. This is because the companies themselves are actually driving those through on the requirement to spend on skills. Then it was asked about, you know, these learners who are graduates, etc., why are they not completing workplace experience? And we've done some studies in that, and I can speak from an employer perspective. A large of that is contributable to the fact that during the experience period, they get placed into employment. Now, there was a very technical issue we had to once deal with at the MQA, is that we could not count our graduates in the workplace experience because they had not gone through the full program, which didn't make sense because for us we wanted to actually create employment opportunities. So some of those decreasing those numbers are being informed from that perspective. So in terms of the bursaries, et cetera, and I don't want to take up, I wish I had a lot of time because I can give PPC all the detail around what the sector does as well. But around bursaries, et cetera, as I've said, we, through our SLP programs and through our HRD programs, and I think acting CEO has actually said, there's this whole co-funding approach that happens with the sector. So apart from the MQA and the grants that we do there, there's a lot driven from the sector as well to almost co-create solutions into the various communities. And I felt it necessary maybe just to mention that it was spoken about what are we doing for women and youth empowerment. I can tell you as a sector, and we're driving it with the MQA, our training and development, because of the amendments in Employment Equity Act and sectoral targeting, is going to be skewed and is skewed towards that arena as well. So you'll see a lot of our initiatives, if you go unpack the granular detail on the learners that we've done, you'll see it's focused on historically disadvantaged women and youth as well in that area. And last but not least, one of the initiatives that we're rolling out with the regulator, the MQA, as well as ourselves as the mining sector to reduce the safety implications is a strategy that we've formulated and working very well on, I think, is Kumbulakaya, which looks at, you know, how do you consistently ensure that your employees who are going into the workplaces are consistently having at front of mind a home to go to and to go home safely. So these are just some of the strategies that we're embarking on jointly with the MQA, with my Labour colleague. It's not often you'll see Labour and business sitting and rubbing shoulders at the same table, but, you know, you do have it as well here, Chair. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I will take care of some of them, and then I will hand over to the CEO, I mean the CFO. And then he'll also hand over to...
No, it's reply to everything. We don't have time to hand over to this, to that. You can hear the bells are ringing now. We must go. So answer all the questions.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. I'll take care of the issue around gender-based violence. We do have, I'll try and be very quick. We do have a policy that deals with that. An issue on the achievement of targets, we agree that we're looking towards achieving better than the 80% that we achieved. On the issue of the inequality, employees not taking up the opportunity, I think Mr. Ali addressed that. We our issue in the MQA is not mainly about learners not taking up the opportunities, it's about completion. In short, that's that. Then in terms of completion rates, where are the learners?
There was an issue, a question around bursaries. We have tracked, traced our bursary learners, 32% of which we found that they were employed, 24% were furthering their studies, 11% were doing other internships, and 6% other jobs. That means that 73% of them, their lives have changed somewhat, and they are moving forward. Only 27% we found that they are unemployed, and over and above the tracer studies that we conducted in the previous year, we are having 5 this year, and we are going to be able to give a report in terms of where these learners that we have funded are. Then in terms of SCM, we don't have issues in the main with regard to SCM. In the interim of 17-18, we had 16 findings, 50%, which was 8 of them, they were related to SCM. But then we went and we cleaned up the SCM, and so much that in the previous, in this year that we're talking about, we only had one finding that pertained to SCM. And by the way, by the time the AG, because it came in the interim, by the time the AG audited, that issue had already been cleared. With regard to others, I think I've already taken care of. Unqualified audit, we agree. We are looking forward to getting an unqualified audit. In terms of program two...
Sorry, the 23 million regular expenditure, you say it's not in your Auditor General's report.
The 23 million, it's actually not 23 million, it's 23,000. That's the one that I've...
Oh, 23,000.
Yeah, it's 23,000. Yeah, it's 23,000. And then, yes, in terms of irregular, it's actually 47,000, not million as well.
Oh, okay.
And then in terms of the program two, the targets 8 and 21, and then 8 and 18, we talked about it, that we have co-funding. When the demand is high, obviously we can only budget based on the money that we have. But when the demand is high, then we talk to the sector and the sector assists. That's why we have got co-funding. And then with regard to the targets 3, 9B, we accept. We are going to plan better because we're talking about out of 2,280 entered, we had 1,152 that completed. I think we underestimated because we already had the pipeline. Our target should have been up. We actually accept that. The other issue as well that we concede to is the EE Youth Employment Equity Youth Quota representation. We have broken down our employment equity in terms of race, but we did not drill it down to the age. So going forward, we are going to drill it down to age, and that is checked. Then the last issue that I can talk to, the compliment that we got in terms of the story that we had to tell, I can only say that it's because of the board that has been very much supportive in terms of what we are trying to achieve, as well as the stakeholders that we have, the labor, as well as the state, and the employers that come on board when we need them to come on board for us to achieve our objectives. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. TETA. TETA.
Thank you, Chairperson. We actually call ourselves TETA. So that everybody can adopt it. TETA has an H in it.
Oh, TETA has an H. TETA.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going to run as quick as I can. I just feel there's a lot more questions and answers that we could provide. And if I get out of hand, you'll have to excuse me. I wouldn't want to leave the portfolio committee with answers rather than questions. There's a question about audit outcomes which the CFO will take care of. But there was a question about what are we doing for women development, and it was related mainly to the taxi industry, that the programs that we do for women, do we have women that are in the taxi industry that are targeted? The answer to that is we've got two types of leadership programs for women. One is for women that are in the workplace, and the other one is for women that are entrepreneurs. With the entrepreneurs, we try to match them with businesses that are looking for supplier and enterprise development partners. We have just recently finished, in the current year, about 6 provinces where we were matching women across all the sectors with business opportunities in the sector as a whole. When it comes to leadership development programs for women, that is for women in the workplace that are meant to be leaders and managers, and that covers the provinces, all of the provinces. It is an open-ended, transparent process where the best are identified through an interview with the business school that runs that program. Question about gender-based violence programs, not yet implemented in the transport industry, though we know that in the taxi industry there's been instances where women have been violated, and we would welcome any collaboration with any role player in the industry that has got a program. The same answer as MQA would have given with regards to the employment equity stats for youth. We don't have it up to that granular detail, but if the committee requires those statistics, they can be provided after this meeting today. There was a question with regards to the unions. We've got many unions, but currently there are two unions whose applications and contracts are being implemented in the current year. We've got DIDAW, which is the Democratized Transport Allied Workers Union, and we also are implementing a project for SATAU, which is another union on our side. But there's also an application that is on the table from NUMSA, which is meant to give NUMSA, I mean, workers in that union, an opportunity, especially those that are called backyard mechanics, to have opportunities to become real business people. There was a question about why companies, we are not meeting deadlines for large companies, I mean large firms and medium firms. It's simply because companies take the process quite late. We open our system for them to submit in October, November, before the deadline, which is end of April. They wait until April to try and load the workplace skills plan and the annual training report, and usually they use consultants, SDFs, who tend sometimes to make mistakes. And when we set the deadline in terms of the regulations, we can't allow them past the deadline. So mainly it's company-based issues that are preventing them from complying. But we don't stop engaging with them to try and encourage them. There was quite an important question about the taxi industry, and I think it came from two members, Honorable Sibiya and even Nodaga. Yeah. So the question about the taxi industry being formalized is something that has been troubling us for a number of years. And to that extent, we've been working with the Unemployment Insurance Fund to try and find ways in which the taxi industry can formalize themselves in the form of cooperatives and then start contributing the skills development levies. As it stands, we don't allocate the taxi industry what they don't contribute, because the rules are you contribute and you get 20% of that which you contributed. Now, the taxi industry currently only contributes 180,000. However, we don't neglect them on the basis of the 180,000. We actually allocate the taxi industry 43 million and subsidize them by taking the revenue from other industries to support the taxi industry, simply because their needs are quite dire. How do we check the level of transformation, and how do we contribute towards transformation in the maritime industry, in the freight handling industry, in the forwarding and clearing industry, and even in aviation? The only levers we have at our disposal is the triple BEE charters. All the companies have to make sure they have enterprise development, they have supplier development, they've got management and control by giving it to people that are previously disadvantaged, and then there's also ownership. Now, when the charters are signed, we strike partnerships with the industry role players that are willing to roll out these programs, and hence we saw the need to roll it first with women in entrepreneurs. Now, transformation is a broad term, but in skills development, your contribution would only be towards making sure there's a capable and a skilled workforce. Whether the industry uses that workforce is something that we totally have no control over. But the there's further inputs that will be given by a colleague of ours who is from the maritime industry, who is a mariner himself, who knows what the issues are. We take the comments about the numerics versus the percentages is quite a useful comment, and going forward, we will make sure that when we make the presentations, we will also take care of the legends, especially to the acronyms. There was a question about training providers. To what extent are we giving preference, or are we supporting SMEs that are from previously disadvantaged communities? We will be able to provide the statistics after today, which we can go and flashback in the office. With regards to targets that exceed 100%, you asked the question, what are the reasons? There are many reasons. One of them is generally carry over from previous years. Sometimes we get more applications in a specific area than planned for, and then what we do, we shift funds to provide and be responsive to the needs that come from the industry. A typical example, we had set the target that we were going to have partnerships with employer bodies. That was going to be 2, but we ended up supporting 4. Now, it looks 200%, but actually the numbers is just 2. The same applies to TVET colleges. The numbers are showing quite a huge jump, and when you look at what the exact numbers are, we were supposed to have 3 partnerships, but we ended up having 8. Stakeholder interventions, work readiness program, we had planned to do 200, but we ended up supporting 300, in some instances with partners and co-funding from other partners. The same applies to career guidance. Sometimes we would plan and say we're going to do 27, then we will get ad hoc requests from different arms of government. And as responsive as we are, we then support and we report it, because whatever we have spent money on, we have to report on it, which is why the jump was from 27 to 56. The same applies to what we call internal career advisors. We always feel that this expos would have better impact if the people that are meeting with the learners understand what the careers are like, what the requirements are like. So in TITA, what we do, we don't just send a staff member to go and conduct a career expo without training them and making them make it of value. Otherwise, it just becomes a day spent in a community without any impact. So we train people that we call career advisors. So we had planned to do 20 externally, but we then invited our internal staff members and extended it to a point where we ended up having 70. The same applies to teachers. We believe a career expo is not an end in itself. Teachers are capacitated to assist the learners in making correct subject choices by being capacitated on what their needs are in the transport sector so that they can help the kids while we've gone back to our offices. With road safety, we had 5, but we ended up giving 9. It's also co-funding, and it's because of partnership requirements. With HIV awareness, we wanted to do 5, but we ended up doing 14 because we extended to all the universities and some universities to see how best we can address the issue of HIV AIDS awareness. There was a question you asked, Honorable Nodada, especially with regard to the percentage of 1,087. That's quite a huge jump from what we had planned. The reason why it is 1,087 is because we had planned to evaluate unit standards for service providers that want to be accredited. So we had targeted 326, but when applications came, more unit standards were required, and we ended up evaluating more, and that made the jump from 30 unit standards to 326 unit standards. It was based on what comes from the industry as a need. The same applies to external moderation. We wanted to do 120, the industry required 268. We had no option but to respond to the industry needs. The same applies to training providers. It was supposed to be 200, we did 305. For lecturers trained as assessors and moderators, we had a number, the demand was higher, we responded to the demand. Now, there was a question that came from Honorable Mukachwa, which was with regards to decentralizing. Why is it that in the transport sector, the bulk of the training happens in Cape Town, Western Cape, if I may put it that way, Gauteng and KZN? It's simply because of the way the economy is set up. Where our companies are largely concentrated is in those three provinces. And would we be able to decentralize it? We won't be able to decentralize it. The reason being, skills development happens in workplaces. So they would need to have workplaces where they go and get a practical component in the workplace. So remedying it would be informed by the economy changing, supporting new entrepreneurs in those areas in the transport sector. And I think to a large extent, the taxi industry can change this picture because they've got a national footprint and they're all over the country. So if they were to contribute, the numbers would change and you would have more based all over the provinces. How many of our small firm support is given to women? We will provide the statistics. We don't have it currently at present. You asked about TVET colleges and the universities. We have colleges spread across the country. There's a college in Bushbuck Ridge called Clarihani. We also support Tshwane South, North Link, Umfolozi TVET College, Orbit in the Northwest, Ikhala in the Eastern Cape, King Sabata in the Eastern Cape, Gersibande in Mpumalanga, Litaba in Limpopo. So those are the TVET colleges that we are supporting. The universities are spread across the length and breadth of the country. The Durban University of Technology, Central University of Technology, University of the Northwest, UJ, TUT, CPUT, NMU, and we also have an agreement with that for research purposes. Now, there was a question where you asked, what are we doing to support unemployed learners? Is it normal for them not to take up opportunities? And our case is, generally, companies look at their operational requirements and balance whether they would release a worker to go for training or focus on making profit. And that tough balancing act has an impact on us in terms of the targets. The trained lecturers, do we monitor what they teach? We don't monitor what they teach. The reason being, what we train them on is on occupationally directed programs, which is what the CETAs and training providers do. So how do we monitor our impact? By seeing more TVET colleges being accredited and not private providers, and rolling out learnerships, apprenticeships, skills programs as what the private providers do. There was a question about the uneven, in fact it was a comment about the unevenness according to the different provinces. I think it relates to the answer I've given, is the makeup of the industry. And the input by one honorable member is about relationship between targets and achievement, and that what formula are we applying, because it can be misleading. We take the point. I think going forward we will show the percentages but also show the numbers so that you can see what these percentages in numbers relate to. There's an issue about can we give in detail transformation, and even an issue about maritime. What's the problem? Why is the maritime industry not transformed? We've got a mariner who can really, as a person who is in the industry, give input as to what the issues are with regards to maritime. There was also a question about digitization by Honorable Nodata. With the advent of Uber and Taxify, do we have any cultivation towards 4IR? The industries that are currently having a cultivation towards 4IR is mainly aviation, because of simulated training and drone piloting, as well as maritime because of simulator training. So the two industries that are really strong in 4IR and digitization is those two. The rest, the taxis, and the rest of the other subsectors not to that extent. But we take your point about in the future giving inputs about where the Tibet colleges are, where the municipalities are, where the learners are based, so that it can be easy for portfolio committee to monitor where these learners are based and if we are making an impact. And the question of lower appetite for higher education and training graduates is mainly attitudinal, and it's all about their work readiness. A university graduate and a TVET college graduate, when they finish, which one is more work ready? Companies choose the ones that they believe is much more work ready than the ones that are coming from university. Another issue so is actually purpose and fit. Are they fit for purpose to be ready to enter a company and start working? But one of the attitudinal things that companies have told us about university graduates, they tend to expect they are going to receive a larger salary because they come from a university. And therefore, companies just believe, let's take workers that have got a better attitude and an expectation and then not create problems for ourselves. But we obviously don't leave it as it is. What we do with our university student graduates is, because we fund a lot of them, every year when they finish, we started about 2 years ago, we're repeating it this year, we combine our learners with the prospective employers. So we call it a graduation celebration day or appreciation day. The main aim is to make it easy for a graduate to meet up with a prospective employer without having to submit CVs, so that we just almost like bring a match, because we believe our job is to bring a match between the employers and the training providers, and in some instances, the students that are trained. I must emphasize that when it comes to consequences management, we apply it without fear or favor. And the questions with regards to why we got irregular expenditure, the CFO would explain whether there was corruption involved, whether there was somebody who was just incompetent, did not apply the rules, or whether it was something more than meets the eye. Then I think after him, we'll hand it over to the very big, difficult question about whether there's a calm before the storm.
CFO.
Thank you, Chair. I'll respond to the issue, I think it's Honorable Svea. With respect to audit opinions, in auditing there is financial audit, there is audit of performance objectives. So the overall opinion is expressed on the financial audit. So over the past 11 years, we've been okay. Even though the opinion on audit of performance objectives is not influencing the overall opinion currently from an auditing standards level, we have gone to the granular details of not relaxing about it, but going to say what is the opinions for each program audited. So I think the progression that you saw on that step highlight over 5 years is showing per program how we have been doing. And I think what happened in 2018-19 shows that we are unqualified. We are much closer to getting even into that clean audit that is our ultimate objective. So over the past 11 years, we've had unqualified. Then coming to the issue around irregular expenditure, I think, Chair, you also asked the same as well. The detail, it's relating to contracts and tenders that would have advertised with an extension clause. So what it means is we knew with respect to those services that we need them or potentially would need them beyond March 2018. The TITA landscape was running until March 2018, but the extension came a bit later because we're not sure, I think, from our executive authority in terms of the future of the landscape. These contracts relate to minute taking, security, cleaning, and internal audit. We introduced an extension clause that I think we had differences with the auditors that they thought it should be a variation. So contracts are allowable legally to have an extension clause, subject to performance, subject to other dynamics. So I think it's quite a technical difference issue that we had around that part. We've engaged with Treasury for the past 7 months. I think they are also battling around that, because if they will respond, if you set a precedent across the country, that any contract and extension clause becomes irregular. So they are really stuck around that part, and I think we are really engaging with Treasury. We will update the committee in terms of the finality around it, but we applied for condonation.
Chairperson and honorable members, let me just assist by wrapping up with the last few questions. I'm going to start with the question that was asked regarding the board composition. That you can easily find on our annual report on page 55, 56, and 59, which include all committees of the board, the four main ones, as well as the fact that all board members are chairpersons of the subsectors, which are eight in total. So it's in the report. The second point is the question around the calm before the storm. Chairperson, I concur that we do have challenges on corporate governance, and we are fully cooperating with the NSA. In the closeout report of theirs, which I think is on page 40, the steps that have been detailed, we've gone through already. The last one, obviously, that is ongoing. Meanwhile, to sort of not leave the impression that there's a calm before the actual storm, the board is functioning very effectively. In fact, in September this year, we did an independent assessment, or we underwent an independent assessment, which was done scientifically, and we were all measured in terms of how effective are we functioning. I'm also the chairperson of the Finance and HR Committee. That committee was assessed over and above the board collectively. Similarly, the GNS committee was assessed, and all the other committees were assessed as to the effectiveness of the board. The overall picture of the effectiveness as recent as September was standing at 83% because it's been scientifically measured. If you committee members for the last issue, as a mariner, having been in the maritime industry, this is my 25th year because I integrated during the dawn of democracy. There's two things that leave this industry not transformed. As a country, we don't own one ship. That's number one. One ship we don't own. Number two, we have four ships by now on our register. Although in numbers we have over 16,000 ships that come in and out of our ports to do business or trade, we don't own one. We only have four in our register. By comparative, Liberia, poor as it is compared to us, has got 1,700 ships on its register. Having said that, this is why the maritime contribution that has been mentioned is so low, because the fact that we don't own ships, we don't have really control to tell them in terms of the contribution. That's number one. Having said that, it further costs this nation over 90 billion annually, because the people that make money are ship owners, operators, and managers, and most of them by far are sitting in Europe. And that on its own is a challenge that the National Department of Transport, using its agency, the South African Maritime Safety Authority, to look into ships register, ship ownership. They are currently looking into that. On the skills side, in terms of transformation and maritime, although it's not on this annual report, TITA co-funded to the sum of 23 million the launch of the first ever public TVET maritime college, which you will find in the middle of a township at Esikaleni in Richards Bay. So that on its own is something that we pride ourselves in, because that's the little control we have on the maritime transformation through skills development. And I thank you, Chairperson, and honorable members.
Okay.
I would have failed if I don't do the closing remarks through you, Chair.
No, you must answer my question.
What is your question, Chair?
You had my question, Chair.
I thought my board member is answering.
No. It doesn't belong to him. He knows it. It belongs to you.
I will answer your question, sir. Honourable members, the matter was investigated at this point by NSA. They've given the summary status quo in terms of the report, the report that they've submitted. We are waiting them to come back to us as a board to give us the resolution or guidance. I must say, without tweaking an eye, as a board we are functioning. It's a matter that is at hand that we had a dispute, and we dealt with it internally, but it has not impacted in terms of the operation of the institution. I can say it without doubting that. We're performing, we're working, probing all the holes in terms of the functionality of the institution. Like any other home, there are dirty linens that need to be sorted, and this is just one of those. I hope I've answered you, and I've taken you into confidence, as you requested.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, thank you, Chair. I hope we are not going to have to come back again to talk about the same thing. I take your assurance that the matter is under control, that we are not going to find ourselves. Because, you know, there are things that are called early warning systems. When the turbulence comes, you must begin to see that, hey, there's things that are coming on the horizon. So I hope it's not that, but otherwise, thank you very much for coming. Did you do your closing remarks? Or was that your closing remarks?
You wanted me to answer the question.
Okay.
And every member sitting was waiting for the answer, and as a chair of the Board of Transport and Education, I am comfortably saying thank you very much for the opportunity. We appreciate the questions that are given, the guidance that was given, and we don't take our mandate lightly in any form or shape. And I must repeat that we have a very robust board that doesn't take answers as easily. We might seem smiling at each other as we're sitting here, but when we get to the boardroom, we do roll up our sleeves and ask each other critical questions, but in a safe space. And I wish to thank all the members for their time.
Okay, thank you very much for engaging with yourself. I think it has been quite a very good engagement, robust, very frank. You can see the honorable members here doing their work. Don't think that people are coming to Parliament to come and sit inside the house and to get tired and to doze off, some of them. No. It does not work like that. We work here, and this is how we roll. This is how we do our things. We have got very effective members here this side. This is how we all roll here in this committee. Very, very robust. You can hear that members are very vigilant. So when you come, we call you here. You must do your work, because you will be faced with these honorable members who don't take any prisoners. So thank you very much. We have asked some information from some of you. Please give us that information. We are watching the space. If you have got difficulties, you must come and ask so that we can help you. But otherwise, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much. Honorable members, let's go to the house.